won odds against him. In discussing Miller's streak in 2003, writers for the Consilient Observer newsletter, published by Credit Suisse First Boston, said that no other fund has ever outperformed the market for a dozen consecutive years in the last 40 years. They raised the question of the probability of a fund's accomplishing that by chance, and went on to give three estimates of that probability. The year being 2003, they referred to the chances of a fund's beating the market for only 12 consecutive years. Those three estimates were 1 in 4,096, 1 in 477,000, and 1 in 2.2 billion. To paraphrase Einstein, if their estimates were correct, they would have needed only one. What were the actual chances? Roughly 3 out of 4, or 75%. That's quite a discrepancy, so I'd better explain. Those who quoted the low odds were right in one sense. If you had singled out Bill Miller in particular at the start of 1991 in particular and calculated the odds that by pure chance the specific person you selected would beat the market for precisely the next 15 years, then those odds would indeed have been astronomically low. You would have had the same odds against you if you had flipped a coin once a year for 15 years, with the goal of having it land heads up each time. But as in the Roger Maris home run analysis, those are not the relevant odds because there are thousands of mutual fund managers, over 6,000 currently, and there were many 15-year periods in which the feat could have been accomplished. So the relevant question is, if thousands of people are tossing coins once a year and have been doing so for decades, what are the chances that one of them, for some 15-year period, will toss all heads? That probability is far, far higher than the odds of simply tossing 15 heads in a row. To make this explanation concrete, suppose 1,000 fund managers, certainly an underestimate, had each tossed a coin once a year starting in 1991, the year Miller began his streak. After the first year, about half of them would have tossed heads. After 2 years, about one quarter of them would have tossed two heads. After the third year, one eighth of them would have tossed three heads, and so on. By then, some who had tossed tails would have started to drop out of the game. But that wouldn't affect the analysis because they had already failed. The chances that, after 15 years, a particular coin tosser would have tossed all heads are then 1 in 32,768. But the chances that someone among the 1,000 who had started tossing coins in 1991 would have tossed all heads are much higher, about 3%. Finally, there is no reason to consider only those who started tossing coins in 1991. The fund managers could have started in 1990 or 1970. Or any other year in the era of modern mutual funds. Since the writers for The Consilient Observer used 40 years in their discussion, I calculated the odds that by chance some manager in the last four decades would beat the market each year for some 15-year period. That latitude increased the odds again, to the probability I quoted earlier, almost 3 out of 4. So rather than being surprised by Miller's streak, I would say that if no one had achieved a streak like Miller's, you could have legitimately complained that all those highly paid managers were performing worse than they would have by blind chance. I've cited some examples of the hot hand fallacy in the context of sports and the financial world. But in all respects of our lives, we encounter streaks and other peculiar patterns of success and failure. Sometimes success predominates, sometimes failure. Either way, it is important in our own lives to take the long view and understand that streaks and other patterns that don't appear random can indeed happen by pure chance. It is also important when assessing others to recognize that among a large group of people, it would be very odd if one of them didn't experience a long streak of successes or failures. No one credited Leonard Coppett for his lopsided successes, and no one would credit a coin tosser. Many people did credit Bill Miller. In his case, though the type of analysis I performed seems to have escaped many of the observers quoted in the media, it is no news to those who study Wall Street from the academic perspective. For example, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, Merton Miller, no relation to Bill, wrote, "If there are 10,000 people looking at the stocks and trying to pick winners, one in 10,000 is going to score, by chance alone, and that's all that's going on. It's a game. It's a chance operation, and people think they are doing something purposeful, but they're really not." We must all draw our own conclusions depending on the circumstances, but with an understanding of how randomness operates, at least our conclusions need not be naive. In the preceding, I've discussed how we can be fooled by patterns in random sequences that develop over time. But random patterns in space can be just as misleading. Scientists know that one of the clearest ways to reveal the meaning of data is to display them in some sort of picture or graph. When we see data exhibited in this manner, meaningful relationships that we would likely have missed are often made obvious. The cost is that we also sometimes perceive patterns that in reality have no meaning. Our minds are made that way, to assimilate data, fill in gaps, and look for patterns. For example, if you were to look at an arrangement of grayish squares in an image, you might realize that the image does not literally look like a human being, yet you can make enough sense of the pattern that if you saw in person the baby pictured, you would probably recognize it. And if you were to take that smudged image and hold it at arm's length and squint, you might not even perceive the imperfections in the image. Now let's think of a pattern of X's and O's in a geometric 5x40 arrangement. Here we might see rectangular clusters, especially in the corners. If the X's and O's represented events of interest, we might be tempted to wonder if those clusters signified something. But any meaning we assigned them would be misconceived because these data are identical to the earlier set of 200 random X's and O's, except for the geometric 5x40 arrangement. This very issue drew much attention toward the end of World War II, when V-2 rockets started raining down on London. The rockets were terrifying, traveling at over 5 times the speed of sound, so that one heard them approach only after they hit. Newspapers soon published maps of the impact sites, which seemed to reveal not random patterns, but purposeful clusters. To some observers, the clusters indicated a precision in the control of the rocket's flight path that, given the distance the rockets had to travel, suggested that German technology was more advanced than anyone had dreamed possible. Civilians speculated that the areas spared were home to German spies. Military leaders worried that the Germans could target crucial military sites, with devastating consequences. In 1946, a mathematical analysis of the bombing data was published in the Journal of the Institute of Actuaries. Its author, R.D. Clark, divided the area of interest into 576 parcels, half a kilometer on each side. Of these, 229 parcels sustained no hits, while, despite their minuscule size, 8 parcels had 4 or 5 hits. Still, Clark's analysis showed that, like the coin toss data before, the overall pattern was consistent with a random distribution. Similar issues arise frequently in reports of cancer clusters. If you divide any city or county into parcels and randomly distribute incidents of cancer, some parcels will receive less than average and some more. In fact, according to Raymond Richard Neutra, chief of the Division of Environmental and Occupational Disease Control in California's Department of Health, given a typical cancer registry, a database on local rates for dozens of different cancers, for California's 5,000 census tracts, you can expect to find 2,750 with statistically significant but random elevations of some form of cancer. And if you look at a large enough number of such parcels, you'll find some regions in which cancer occurred at many times the normal rate. The picture looks even worse if you draw the parcel boundaries after the cancers are distributed. What you get then is called the sharpshooter effect. After the apocryphal fellow who excels in his aim because he shoots at blank paper and draws the target afterward. Unfortunately, that is how it usually happens in practice. First, some citizens notice neighbors with cancer. Then they define the boundaries of the area at issue. Thanks to the availability of data on the internet, America these days is being scoured for such clusters. Not surprisingly, they are being found. Yet the development of cancer requires successive mutations. That means very long exposure and/or highly concentrated carcinogens. For such clusters of cancer to develop from environmental causes and show themselves in concert and before the victims have moved away from the affected area is quite a long shot. According to Nutra, to produce the kind of cancer clusters epidemiologists are typically called on to investigate, a population would have to be exposed to concentrations of carcinogens that are usually credible only in patients undergoing chemotherapy or in some work settings, far greater concentrations than people receive in contaminated neighborhoods and schools. Nevertheless, people resist accepting the explanation that the clusters are random fluctuations. And so, each year, state departments of health receive thousands of residential cancer cluster reports, which result in the publication of hundreds of exhaustive analyses, none of which has convincingly identified an underlying environmental cause. Says Alan Bender, an epidemiologist with the Minnesota Department of Health, those studies are an absolute, total, and complete waste of taxpayer dollars. So far in this chapter, we have considered some of the ways in which random patterns can fool us. But psychologists have not contented themselves to merely study and categorize such misperceptions. They have also studied the reasons we fall prey to them. Let's now turn our attentions to some of those factors. People like to exercise control over their environment, which is why many of the same people who drive a car after consuming half a bottle of scotch will freak out if the airplane they are on experiences minor turbulence. Our desire to control events is not without purpose, for a sense of personal control is integral to our self-concept and sense of self-esteem. In fact, one of the most beneficial things we can do for ourselves is to look for ways to exercise control over our lives, or at least to look for ways that help us feel that we do. The psychologist Bruno Bettelheim observed, for instance, that survival in Nazi concentration camps depended on one's ability to arrange to preserve some areas of independent action, to keep control of some important aspects of one's life, despite an environment that seemed overwhelming. Later studies showed that a prior sense of helplessness and lack of control is linked to both stress and the onset of disease. In one study, wild rats were suddenly deprived of all control over their environment. They soon stopped struggling to survive and died. In another study, in a group of subjects who were told they were going to take a battery of important tests, even the pointless power to control the order of those tests was found to reduce anxiety levels. One of the pioneers in the psychology of control is the psychologist and amateur painter Ellen Langer, now professor at Harvard. Years ago, when she was at Yale, Langer and a collaborator studied the effect of the feeling of control on elderly nursing home patients. One group was told they could decide how their rooms would be arranged and were allowed to choose a plant to care for. Another group had their rooms set up for them and a plant chosen and tended to for them. Within weeks, the group that exercised control over their environment achieved higher scores on a pre-designed measure of well-being. Disturbingly, 18 months later, a follow-up study shocked researchers. The group that was not given control experienced a death rate of 30%, whereas the group that was given control experienced a death rate of only 15%. Why is the human need to be in control relevant to a discussion of random patterns? Because if events are random, we are not in control. And if we are in control of events, they are not random. There is, therefore, a fundamental clash between our need to feel we are in control and our ability to recognize randomness. That clash is one of the principal reasons we misinterpret random events. In fact, inducing people to mistake luck for skill or pointless actions for control is one of the easiest enterprises a research psychologist can engage in. Ask people to control flashing lights by pressing a dummy button, and they will believe they are succeeding even though the lights are flashing at random. Show people a circle of lights that flash at random and tell them that by concentrating, they can cause the flashing to move in a clockwise direction, and they will astonish themselves with their ability to make it happen. Or have two groups simultaneously compete in a similar enterprise. One strives for clockwise motion along the circle, and the other attempts to make the lights travel counterclockwise, and the two groups will simultaneously perceive the lights traveling around the circle in the direction of their intention. Langer showed again and again how the need to feel in control interferes with the accurate perception of random events. In one of her studies, participants were found to be more confident of success when competing against a nervous, awkward rival than when competing against a confident one, even though the card game in which they competed, and hence their probability of succeeding, was determined purely by chance. In another study, she asked a group of bright and well-educated Yale undergraduates to predict the results of 30 random coin tosses. The experimenters secretly manipulated the outcomes so that each student was correct exactly half the time. They also arranged for some of the students to have early streaks of success. After the coin tosses, the researchers quizzed the students in order to learn how they assessed their guessing ability. Many answered as if guessing a coin toss were a skill they could cultivate. One quarter reported that their performance would be hampered by distraction. 40% felt that their performance would improve with practice. And when asked directly to rate their ability at predicting the tosses, the students who achieved the early streaks of success rated themselves better at the task than did the others, even though the number of successes was the same for all the subjects. In another clever experiment, Langer set up a lottery in which each volunteer received a sports trading card with a player's picture on it. A card identical to one of the distributed cards was placed in a bag with the understanding that the participant whose card it matched would be declared the winner. The players were divided into two groups. Those in one group had been allowed to choose their card. Those in the other had been handed a card at random. Before the drawing, each participant was given the opportunity to sell his or her card. Obviously, whether participants chose their cards or were handed them had no effect on their chances of winning. Yet those who had chosen their own cards demanded more than four times as much money for them as those selling the randomly assigned cards. The subjects in Langer's experiments knew, at least intellectually, that the enterprises in which they were engaged were random. When questioned, for example, none of the participants in the trading card lottery said they believed that being allowed to choose their card had influenced their probability of winning. Yet, they had behaved as if it had. Or, as Langer wrote, while people may pay lip service to the concept of chance, they behave as though chance events are subject to control. In real life, the role of randomness is far less obvious than it was in Langer's experiments, and we are much more interested in the outcomes and our ability to influence them. And so, in real life, it is even more difficult to resist the illusion of control. One manifestation of that illusion occurs when an organization experiences a period of improvement or failure, and then readily attributes it not to the myriad of circumstances constituting the state of the organization as a whole, and to luck, but to the person at the top. That's especially obvious in sports, where, as I mentioned in the prologue, if the players have a bad year or two, it is the coach who gets fired.